Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you since 1997 on KKUP Radio with over 250 guests and still going strong in their 12th year of weekly broadcasting, the International Taz and Paula Show brings to you expansive, engaging, and groundbreaking intensity on radio and now on the internet airwaves today. Listen live every Thursday or visit Embracing Mother Earth's archives, exclusive articles, ask questions, and receive actual answers from guests anytime at TazandPaulaShow.com. Taz and Paula's special guests are experts coming from all walks of life, energizing our lives with a passion that inspires and teaches us with each of their compelling personal life journeys, with roots from ancient wisdom and bridging it with modern science. We hope today's show touches the wisdom of your heart. And now, Taz and Paula.
Hi, this is Paula, and you're listening to the Taz and Paula Show. And boy, today we have an exciting show. We are going to be speaking to Stephen Myler, who has had connections in Egypt all through the takeover, and he is going to be able to tell us more than what we ever heard from the media. So, Taz, are you there?
Oh, I am. I'm here.
Oh, and, Stephen.
Well, you know, Stephen really is with this, but he always brings out the most unusual, up-to-date research possible. And he's an independent Egyptologist and has spent over 30 years researching the history of Egypt. Plus, he's been able to uncover an indigenous oral tradition that still exists in Egypt and has studied with a living master of this tradition, Abd el-Hakim Awin, also known as Hakim. And Stephen's fascination with ancient Egypt began at the age of 8. Boy, that was young. And he has guided his own education and spiritual work all his life. He holds 3 degrees in the sciences and is a trained field archaeologist and prehistorian. Stephen also served as a staff research scientist for the Rosicrucian Order in San Jose, California, from 1978 to 1980. And in his newest book, The Land of Osiris, An Introduction to Hematology, he writes that the pyramids may have been used for energy devices instead of tombs. Wow, Paula.
Well, Stephen's other book, From Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt, was based over 15 years of work with Hakim, and Stephen's almost 40 years of research in this area. Stephen is currently the director of research of both the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association and his own Land of Osiris Research Project. He also leads tours to Egypt and is working on his third book. Stephen has researched the phenomenon of crystal skulls since 1979. We have a mutual friend. Our mutual friend Max, especially those known as ancient crystal skulls. Personally, he has experienced and tested 4 skulls that he has labeled ancient artifacts and has seen as many as 9 that could fit that category. Stephen has written a book on the subject with David Hatcher Childress, The Crystal Skulls, Astonishing Portals to Man's Past. Boy, Stephen, there's some exciting times. I mean, first Egypt and now Libya.
Yes.
We've got a lot to talk about today.
Well, thank you both ladies for that great introduction.
Well, it's always exciting to have you with us, that's for sure. You open doors of areas that not many people get a chance to know about, so we're ready for today.
Thank you.
You have connections that not many people have connections with Egypt, so you've got some behind-the-scenes information for us, I'm sure.
Yes, well, as you both mentioned, I was very blessed and fortunate to have an indigenous teacher, Hakim, Abdel Hakim Awyan is the correct name, but everybody knew him as Hakim. He passed away in 2008, but at the age of 8 years, and was his main disciple. And so I had the great fortune of not only having a master of the oral tradition to learn about ancient Egypt, but someone to also give me a detailed history of modern Egypt, as in fact he had lived it. Born in 1926, he was born right after the 1919 revolution in Egypt, where the Ottoman Empire had broken up and the Egyptians broke away from the Turkish rulers and the British and became a constitutional monarchy. So Hakim would tell me about growing up under King Fouad and then King Farouk, and then, of course, the revolution in 52 with Nasser and then Sadat and Mubarak. So I did have that background. And also, because of the wonder thing of the social networking, which was really such a major influence beginning in Tunisia and especially in Egypt in promoting these revolutions, I have many Egyptian friends on Facebook, and I was getting real-time chats and information from what was going on in Tahrir Square. So I didn't have to always depend on the media, but also I've been glued to Al Jazeera English, and I would recommend that station to anyone for the last 2-3 weeks, because they have done the best reporting about what's going on in the area, far and away the best reporting.
Can you repeat that again so our listeners can
Jot it down? People, it's Al Jazeera. That's the Arab station that comes out of Saudi Arabia, and Al Jazeera English is actually a website. People can go on it, and you can actually be on real time when they're covering what's going on in Libya very strong now, because at the beginning there was a complete media blackout in Libya, but now reporters are getting in. There are now Al Jazeera reporters on the ground in Libya and giving us real time information. It's been a pretty amazing thing. This is something that we have never seen in our lifetimes, these type of revolutions, particularly in Egypt. Because it basically was a partyless, leaderless revolution. There was no particular party behind it. There was no particular main group. It started out as bloggers. It started out with people on the internet trying to form groups to protest for political reform, for changes. And then there's actually two groups that started. There's what's called the April 6th group. It was a group of young, many, many Egyptian women were involved in this group to try to ask for reform, to try to get Mubarak, at that time not to step down, but for reform, just to change, get some real democracy in the country. That was followed up by another movement. There was a blogger named Khalid Said, who was blogging in the town of Alexandria. He was reporting on the excesses of the security, the torture, the terrible brutality that was going on against the Egyptian people. He was arrested. This was in June of 2010. He was arrested, detained, and beaten to death. His battered body was then pictured all over YouTube. So they started a movement, We Are All Khalid Said. So it was these two groups that started the protests January 25th in Tahrir Square.
Well, just think of what social media has done, Facebook, and it's really brought people together to move in a certain direction.
It's been amazing. It's truly been amazing to watch this, because I was not surprised. And again, my teacher, Hakim, we spoke many, many years ago about these things, about Mubarak and about this, and he was very hopeful that what we call the awakening, which is what's happening around the world, which is one of our main teachings that he gave us, that we're coming to the end of great cycles now. Again, the Mayan calendar tells that, the Hopi, all indigenous people all around the world are talking about, we're coming to the end of great cycles now, and this is exactly what Hakim taught. And he called this time that we're coming in the awakening, that people would start to rise in consciousness. And he's been coming to me strong now, saying that, see, Stephen, I told you you would see signs of the awakening, and the awakening is beginning in Kemet. Kemet, of course, is the ancient term for Egypt. And so it's starting in the ancient land. And this was definitely a movement of spirit. People didn't think this would happen. The Mubarak was entrenched for 30 years. He was such a brutal dictator. These things have happened before, but they have not been advertised in the West. There have been protests. There have been movements. Usually he crushes them, like what started this time. And it disappears, and no one hears anything about it. But when he was given the word, a very interesting quote that has come across, and it's actually quoted by somebody who was standing right next to him and got the words exact. When he first heard that there were a series of youth groups that were going to be gathering January 25th in Tahrir Square, which means liberation, he just said, let them have fun. Totally out of touch with what was going on. And then when he started to react, it was way too late. The momentum built. Then they started to crack down with brutality. But the people were not afraid anymore. The difference this time, and this is what you're seeing in Libya, you're even seeing it in Iran, you're seeing it all across. If you would look at a map now, you would see that all of North Africa is now involved in this. Started in Tunisia, moved to Egypt, now in Libya, also in Morocco and Algeria, also in Tunis, as well as Syria, Jordan, Bahrain, Iraq is now, and Iran. So this is, you would see that these the people are no longer afraid. This is a sign of the awakening. This is a sign of the consciousness growth that we've all been taught is going to happen. They are no longer afraid. So they what happened is when, in January 28th, when they started the security police, and it's a long discussion to go into exactly what Mubarak's police situation was. It's what's called the Department of the Ministry of the Interior. They were the part of security. Security in Egypt exists in many different levels. There are, of course, your uniformed police. You see them. There are also undercover police. There's uniformed antiquities police. There's also undercover antiquities police. It is the undercover police, the people who went in plain clothes but were always packing heat. I could always spot them. Hakim taught me how to spot them in the crowds. They're always in the or at the sites. There's these plainclothes antiquities police as well as the plainclothes security, always at the sites. You could always see them. You could always spot them carrying weapons. And they were the ones who have been acting for 30 years with total impunity, raping, pillaging, and murdering Egyptian citizens without ever being brought to justice. So on January 28th, when they reacted, the police came out with the water cannons and the rubber bullets and live ammunition. No longer did the people just cow and give in. They reacted. They threw these people off the train. They burned down police stations. They took 30 years of frustration to act against these brutal people, particularly the plainclothes who've been doing this for years. And no longer afraid, they broke the power. Once the military did not stand with him, it was very simple how it ended in Egypt. The Egyptian military is homegrown. Opposed, we can talk about Libya as being different, but Egyptian military is homegrown. Particularly the junior officers in the last 20 years have all been trained in the U.S. at the Pentagon, very close, very friendly with U.S. military officers. The conscripted, the enlisted people are all conscripted. You have forced conscription in Egypt. Every male that reaches the age of 18 is supposed to spend 3 years in the military. So all the conscripted people were all Egyptian citizens. They were not going to fire on their cousins, their brothers, their uncles, their sisters, and their mothers. So right away there was a split in the military. The senior officers were loyal to Mubarak. That's why it went on as long as if it all been the way it eventually went, it would have ended really quickly. But it went on 18 days because the senior officers were still loyal to Mubarak. But the Pentagon made the call. For all who want to know the truth, the Pentagon made the call. The senior U.S. officers convinced the senior Egyptian officers that there was going to be a split in the military. The junior officers and the conscripted soldiers had joined in the protests. They were not going to fire on their own people. The senior officers also did not want to fire on their own people, and they eventually broke with Mubarak. And once he lost the control of the senior officers as well as the whole military, it was over, and he had to leave. Now, the difference is in Libya is a big difference.
Well, in Libya, I just heard that the pilots refused to, actually the crew on the planes jumped off the plane and
yes,
refused to shoot against their own people.
Yes. Now, what's happening in Libya is because Gaddafi. Now, I was going on a lot of different radio shows and a lot of different talking about it. Mubarak was senile. There's no doubt he was totally out of touch with his people, and he has been brutal before. But he's not crazy. He did not want to turn his country into a total bloodbath. If the Egyptian military had turned on the people, you would have been looking at not only thousands, but tens of thousands of casualties. It would have been horrendous. So he was not that crazy. But But Gaddafi, this man has been insane for 30 years. He is totally insane. What he has done has been hiring mercenaries for 30 years. He has his normal army, his normal security, and his private forces, and so he has been hiring mercenaries. So this is why it is very bloody in Libya and is getting more and more bloody, because he had his loyal guard and the mercenaries have been firing live rounds on people. I mean, I don't even want to go into graphic detail, but it's been shown on Al Jazeera that these mercenaries actually turned anti-aircraft and anti-tank weapons on people. There were doctors reporting they could only find pieces of people, and I don't want to go any further than that. It's been documented how horrendous Gaddafi has done this. But what, as you've seen, the military is splitting. The first move was two Air Force jets who were went to Malta with two higher Libyan Air Force colonels. They defected a couple of days ago. Two warships. He's lost Benghazi. The real major confrontation began in Benghazi, which is one of the eastern cities of Libya. Benghazi has been totally overrun. They sent two warships to invade Benghazi to kill their own people. The warship sailed to Malta, and they defected. As you mentioned, an Air Force pilot who was sent to bomb Benghazi, he ejected out of his plane and let the plane crash. All of eastern Libya has fallen. Now the west is starting to fall. So what is happening now, unfortunately, this could possibly be very bloody. There's going to be a couple of different scenarios. What has happened in the eastern side of Libya is the army has defected. They have joined the protests, and they have opened up the storehouses. So now what became in Egypt was basically an unarmed peaceful, nonviolent revolution. They responded in kind to the violence that was put against them, but basically they succeeded in Egypt and Tunisia by being nonviolent. They started out in Libya being nonviolent, but that has changed now because of the wanton murder, and it's at least 1,000 Libyans have been killed. Again, they've opened up the storehouses. These people are heavily armed now, and they are heading to Tripoli. Thousands of armed Libyans are heading to Tripoli to confront Gaddafi and his armed, his loyal guard. So there's only just a couple of scenarios that could happen now. One, somebody loyal, close to Gaddafi is going to have to take him out. Or two, someone loyal, very close to Gaddafi is going to have to get him out of the country, say it's lost, you have no control, get out of the country. Or he's going to fight to the death, as he's promised, to die a martyr. And this is going to be a very, very bloody civil war, which will end in Gaddafi's death.
Plus he has his sons and everyone else that's in the in the government, so
there's been a real disappointment with one of his sons. His son Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi, was considered to be the one who was going to take over and lead Libya into the 21st century. He has a PhD in economics from the London School of Economics. He's been an agent of BP. He's involved in one of the major oil deals there. Everybody, he's been promising reforms. He's been promising democracy. Everybody thought he would take a stand here. He made this incredible, insane speech the other night, where saying that it's going to be rivers of blood, that they're drug addicts, Gaddafi made a speech this morning where he is blaming it all on bin Laden now, saying bin Laden is giving LSD to the Libyan youth. This is how insane he is.
Wow.
But Egypt has been a totally beautiful experience, and what will come now will be what we have to see. And what I'm hoping, because of my deep connection with the Egyptian people, that it's going to be a lot of the Egyptian women who are going to lead the way. This is why I do not see this country becoming an Islamist state. I do not see them going to Sharia law. Egypt, because of Mubarak and Sadat, is the most moderate Muslim country in the world. There are more women in Egypt who've gotten PhDs, who are professionals, than any other Muslim country in the world. And they will not go back. If you saw the demonstrations in Tahrir Square, if you've seen a lot of the leaders, they were women. They were Muslim women, they were Christian women, they were secular Muslim women, but they were women. And I'm hoping that they will not back down and that they will continue to play an important role. I would even love to see an Egyptian woman president, a moderate Muslim woman, but I would love to see more women get involved in the politics of Egypt, get into political power. That will guarantee that there will not be Sharia law in return. This is Islam's big mission now. This is Islam's biggest challenge now, to come into the 21st century. What is it the most that keeps Islam from joining the world nations? It is their treatment of women.
Well, Egypt is leading the way. We look at the what's happening in the future, I've been told that the female energy is what's going to shift and change things. So it's
right
probably starts in Egypt.
Well, I mean, again, that has got to be what changes Islam. If Islam is going to continue into the 21st century, it has to be moderate Muslim women who are dedicated to their faith, believe in their faith, but are not going to stand to being second-class citizens and not being able to vote, to achieve all status. Even in Egypt, a woman is not as equal as a man. Is there more equal there than any other Muslim country? But even in Egypt, a woman cannot engage in a contract. She cannot engage in a professional services without her husband's permission. This all has to change, and believe me, I see that in the young Egyptian women. They are going to come in. This is going to become, in my fervent hope, eventually a complete democratic nation, but at least at first it has to be a representative democracy where you will have Muslims, Christians, and even non-believers to be able to sit at the table and be a part of the Egyptian system. I see that. I'm very, very hopeful. I believe very strongly in the Egyptian people. They are some of the most creative, resourceful people on the planet.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Stephen, do you see the governments in the other areas, if, you know, Gaddafi does go down and eventually lay down his sword, or simply if he's killed, do you see anything as far as spreading to the other countries?
Oh, it already has.
A more easing? Well, I mean, it has spread to the other countries, but do you see an easing of perhaps people not being as violent in those countries?
Yes. That's a good question. It's difficult to say. Definitely Gaddafi is the worst-case scenario. People thought it would be Mubarak. I knew it would not be Mubarak. Even though I knew Mubarak had been a brutal dictator for 30 years, I knew he would not turn the country into bloodbath. Gaddafi is the craziest. What it looks like will be the hardest, of course, will be Iran. And it is not
right.
Over in Iran. Even though you're not hearing anything about Iran now, they supposedly have crushed it again. It is not over in Iran. Iran will be the most difficult. Will probably, for the people to change that regime, to throw out the mullahs, that will be very, very difficult. We're hopeful that it wouldn't be as, you know, but Bahrain is having problems now. You see, because what we are in Bahrain, although a lot of the violence has subsided because of U.S. influence, the people really want the whole royal class out in Bahrain. They want these Sunni relatives of the Saudi royal family who are running Bahrain, which is a majority Shia country, to leave, to simply go. That's going to be difficult. So I think Egypt may and Tunisia may wind up being the easiest, although Tunisia is still having a lot of problems. People don't understand. It's not over in Tunisia. There's still a lot of unemployment. There's still a lot of arrests. A lot of Tunisians are leaving the country and going to Italy. There's a real and a lot of Libyans are leaving the country, going to Malta and Italy. So there's going to be a big immigration problem, a big refugee problem. But I don't know if it's going to be I think Egypt will wind up perhaps being the easiest. If you look at Syria, Syria's not going to go down easy. Jordan, they're making major concessions. Algeria's making concessions, Morocco, etc. But I don't know. I mean, no doubt if they're going to have to make a regime change in Iran, it will not be easy and it will not be peaceful.
And I hear Saudi Arabia is buying off their people.
Oh, yes. Couple of months supposedly having medical treatment, he gave a couple $1,000s to each person. You know, I'm sure they can do that. I mean, again, Gaddafi was doing that too. Gaddafi used to do that all the time, buy off the people and buy off all the cronies around him.
Now, in Iraq, wasn't Iraq, the women had rights at one time in Iraq?
Yes. Yes. In fact, under Saddam, Iraqis had most freedom except for Egyptians. At one time, the best medical facilities in the Middle East were in Iraq, no longer. But what's happening in Iraq is people don't want to overthrow the government. Of course, they already did that. But the government has been too corrupt. I mean, the puppets that we put in there have not done representative democracy. The women are not being represented still enough in Iraq. And so that's why the people are protesting there. They want governmental changes. They want change. They're not protesting for overthrow the government, but they definitely want changes too. And this will spread. I mean, it's going to spread. It's here. It's going to spread to Europe. It's going to spread to the U.S. I mean, we're going to have major demonstrations in the U.S. if these Republicans continue on and crush unions.
Oh, yeah, I see that coming.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can see a big march on Washington. I mean, let's get back to the 60s. It's funny, my wife and I, when we were watching the early parts of the Egyptian Revolution, my wife just kept saying, it looks like the 60s have finally hit Egypt. Because it was that type of a protest. It was.
Yeah.
I talked a couple years ago to an astrologer, and he predicted, because of the stars are similar to the 60s right now.
Yeah.
And we're going to see a lot of demonstrations all over the world, which is coming through.
Right. Right. Well, it's funny. The Egyptians were even chanting, we are the 60s. I mean, it's funny. I mean, they were. They're so sophisticated. Because of the Internet, Facebook, all of this, and Twitter, I mean, they are so sophisticated technologically. They're on websites every day, English websites, Arabic websites. They know what's going on. They're very, very aware, the youth of Egypt, and that's why they were able to do this.
Well, what's really the good thing I see coming through all of this is the Westerners, I think, are beginning to look at the Muslims and the countries differently. I mean, we can see that they're not as bad as we've been brainwashed that they are.
Well, I'm glad you think that way, because that, to me, is one of the biggest problems I see in the U.S. right now is Islamophobia and being fostered and ginned up by the extreme right. So, I mean, it's great. I mean, I see what you're saying among young people in the U.S., but not among older people. I see incredible ignorance and prejudice against Muslims. Incredible.
Yeah, I know I've seen it on the Internet. And it's usually in the age group of 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds, they have the phobia.
I know, and it's a shame. Yeah, there is... And that has to do with, you know, what do we think is going to happen? You're getting a lot of what people call the Zionist press that's been controlled by Israel or in the U.S., or just this real negative reaction against Islam, that the Muslim Brotherhood's going to take over Egypt and it's going to break the treaty with Israel and join all the Arab nations and they're going to destroy Israel. I mean, that is a possibility, but is it a remote possibility? Again, because of my advantage of going to Egypt for the last 19 years, 14 times in the last 18 years, this will be the 19th year I'm going this year. A couple of years ago, I was with my group in Aswan, which is in the south, and I left my group for a couple hours. We had some free time. I went off just by myself wandering. I went to a little park, and I saw a couple, a man, a wife, and a child, and obviously I saw the man's dress. He was a fundamentalist Muslim, no doubt about it, with the beard, the hat, the white robe, everything. I said, Assalamu alaikum. He said, back to me. We just sat down, and I didn't say anything else, but he started to stare at me, and finally he said to me in English, are you American? I said, yes. He says, I speak English. I said, great. And we got into a long, protracted discussion for hours. We discussed Islam. We discussed Egypt. We discussed politics. We discussed everything. Now, what I got from, and he was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, a high-ranking member. I want to make that clear. He made it clear to me, his own opinion. He said, the Muslim Brotherhood today is not a homogeneous group. There are many different people who belong to the Muslim Brotherhood, from radical extremists to moderate Muslims to women, etc., to professionals, all belong to the Muslim Brotherhood. He said, as far as he was concerned, he personally was not interested in breaking any treaties with Israel, was not interested in a war with Israel, and he was not interested in an Islamic State or in instituting Sharia law. He was just interested in having a seat at the table. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood was outlawed in Egypt. It was outlawed in 1948. Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak have all crushed the leaders, jailed and killed them, etc. They at one time did practice violence. No one's going to disagree with that. They practice political assassinations. But they have matured. They want to be a political force. They want to make sure that Islamic values are still important in Egypt. That's why they want a seat at the table. But as I've told everyone, if there was a general election tomorrow, open election in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood would not win more than 25% of the vote. It's not going to become an Islamic State. And so they deserve a right to have a legal party. They deserve a right to have a seat at the table. They deserve a right to express their desire for Islamic values to be important, to be essential, but not to have Sharia law be the law of the state. And I think that is the majority of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, I know there are extremists. I know there are those that would want to go after Israel and wipe it out for sure, and remove all American influence from the area for sure. What will happen now in the Middle East, you can be sure that the geopolitical situation will change. No matter what government comes into power in Egypt, they will not be the same as Mubarak and Sadat, of course, being so generous to Israel, so looking the other way. They will be critical of Israelis' policies. They will support the Palestinians. They feel that they will have a right to criticize Israel. But criticizing Israel does not mean that they're going to go to war with Israel. Simple.
Now, the way things stand right now, is the military going to be in charge until there's an election September?
That is a good point. What is happening now is that it's being discussed. What you will see another demonstration tomorrow. They are going to make this an ongoing thing that every Friday after prayers, of course Friday is the holy day, they're going to be gathering in Tahrir Square and demonstrating again, peacefully, just to let the military know that they're still around and we're waiting for you. What the military has promised is a series of steps. First, a total reformation of the Constitution. Basically, the Egyptian constitution has to be rewritten with basic rights, Bill of Rights like we have, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, etc., etc. Second, they have to remove martial law. What people don't understand is that when Mubarak came to power after the assassination of Sadat, because they blamed the Muslim Brotherhood for the assassination, they put Egypt under martial law, under emergency law. No political parties, no assemblies. No, this has been in effect for 30 years. He never lifted it. So they have to do that and do that soon. Lift emergency law. Then they have to make the preparations for political parties to form, to meet in conference with the military and set a date for elections. Then the military has to withdraw. And the military has already said they will form no candidates. They will not take part in the elections. They do not want any control politically of Egypt. They want to go back. Right now it is under military law, no doubt. But little by little, commerce is returning to Egypt, banks are opening, transactions are going, tourists are coming back, not Americans yet, but we know that there is a Dutch group, a French group, a German group, Brazilian groups are now coming into Egypt, so tourists are returning. Things are trying to get back to normal. But yes, this is very important. They do not want the military to stay having a controlled presence for too much longer. It cannot last more than a month or so where they're going to have to start to let go and start forming provisional governments to oversee a general election. And so but believe me, the Egyptians are not going to let that happen. They are going to continue to be protested, continue to march, continue to put pressure on the military that they do not any longer want in Egypt any remnant of a military dictatorship. Gone. Over. Fini.
They might end up being freer than we are.
That's a great point. You know that?
Yeah.
If they actually would have total representative democracy, I mean, I don't think we have that here, you know?
No.
Well, look, I mean, you know, I'm, you know, I'm bringing this up when I talk to this to people all the time. I mean, all of this Islamophobia, all of this, what would happen, Sharia law, what happens, and then there's some states like Oklahoma or Idaho are actually passing resolutions that outlawing Sharia law, like it's actually a possibility that would happen in the U.S. But I tell people, how many members of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives are fundamentalist Christians? How many of them are influencing U.S. policy right now? Why does nobody ever speak about that? You're worried about Islam and Sharia law. What about these Tea Partiers who've been elected who want to see the Ten Commandments oversee the Constitution? What about that threat? Nobody ever talks about that.
Yeah, when religion and government are not supposed to intertwine.
That was Tom Jefferson and James Madison.
Yeah, with the Tea Partiers, you can see all the way from a moderate person to fundamentalist Christian. I mean, they're all types are in the Tea Party.
Yes, you're right. But a lot of, unfortunately, what comes out as being a predominant philosophy comes out being fundamentalist Christian values. Again, what did they do when they first got elected? Have you noticed what's going on in the House of Representatives? All these Tea Partiers jumped in. The Republicans got the House. All right, they're going to suddenly put their agendas. Okay, what about jobs? What about the economy? Not one proposal. The first three bills that they instituted in our house was, one, defunding health care, putting poor people back out in the street, and stringent anti-abortion law, outlawing, making it basically, not only can any federal funds never be used by abortion, but they're actually trying to propose that not even private insurance funds could be used to fund an abortion. So this is the agenda. So yes, you're right, the Tea Party is all those groups involved, but why is it that it's the fundamentalist Christian agenda which is dominating them in the House of Representatives?
Well, hopefully this shall change. I mean, yeah. When the unions are being taken out, and I'm sure it's going to...
Well, I mean, the 2012 battleground is now being set here in 2011. This is the election for next year. It's the Republicans and the right wing making war on public employees and unions. That's going to be the fight next year. And so what happens in Wisconsin is very pivotal for the rest of the nation.
Now, why do you think Obama's really been quiet about everything that's happening in Libya and Egypt?
Well, I actually think he did the right moves in Egypt. In Libya. He cannot do these things overtly. I mean, this is why the Muslim world against us and attacks us for trying to determine, we went into Iraq and we deposed a dictator. Did the Iraqis invite us in? No. So, I mean, this is why the Muslim world is in such distrust of us. So he had Hillary make the opening statements. He had to let things go. He could not just immediately come out and say, okay, Mubarak, you have to go. He cannot be seen be telling people what in other countries what to do. And Gaddafi, any statement Obama would have made against Gaddafi, Gaddafi would have twisted. Even if he had supported him, he would have twisted it. So I believe in that situation, he has made the right moves. It has to be, because it was the Pentagon, it was our generals who really determined what happened in Egypt. But on the other hand, I do agree with those that are very critical in that he's not saying anything about what's going on in Wisconsin and that he is not backing the unions and the working people who are the Democratic Party base and who got him elected. That, I think, is room for criticism. But I think as far as foreign policy about what's going on there, he did make the right moves. And when Iran came out and started crushing their demonstrators, he spoke out strongly that Iran was being hypocritical by supporting the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt and then crushing their own.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't realize that they supported the other revolutions.
Ahmadinejad came out with a statement yesterday supporting all the movements in the Middle East, saying these are great because Muslim people that are rising up to throw American and Israeli influence out. So then he says it's going to spread to Europe and it's going to spread to America. That's what he's saying. But what about your own country, pal? What about your own country? You got to go. Iran, the world will never be totally free and safe with this regime in Iran the way it is. And again, the Iranian youth are also there. They were able to crushing brutality with camera phones, with tweeting that they kept the messages going. They have as brutal as Gaddafi has been in Libya is what Ahmadinejad and the mullahs have been in Iran. I mean, putting to death anybody who speaks out in protest.
Well, they can turn off the social media. I mean, they can just turn it off. So,
but they can't stop it. You see, this is what happened in Egypt. He tried to do that. He was late. Mubarak was always 3 or 4 days behind the protesters. But when he did cut off the Facebook and he did cut off Twitter and then he cut all mobile phones, they had already become expert at organizing. They didn't need it anymore. They went from street to street, from neighborhood to neighborhood, from word to word, and hundreds of thousands of people gathered. And he's done the same in Libya. He totally cut off all media, all things, but people are still doing camera phones. Still finding mobiles that work and talking. You can't stop it anymore. You can't stop it. This is the 21st century. This is exactly what Hakim called the awakening. Things are going to happen around the world now, and they can no longer be totally blacked out. At one time, these dictators could do that. They can't do that anymore.
Yeah, the world has certainly gotten smaller.
It sure has.
It's almost like we're right in our backyard.
Well, it's so good. It really does shake people. it gives people courage in other areas to say, hey, you know, we can do it. And it's really uplifting to feel
very much
this.
So.
Yeah.
One of the greatest teaching that Hakim really gave to us was that once we rate what we do at the sites in Egypt, which we all can do, we lose our fears. The biggest fear that human beings have is the fear of death. It is what religions base themselves on so they can control people. So what we're seeing, what we actually saw, is these people losing their fear. I mean, if you go, there's so many stories. There are just so many incredible things. You see a group of Libyans approaching the police with holding their arms out and their shirts open, exposing their chests. You're going to shoot me? Shoot me. I'm showing this to the world. And then they get shot down and killed. What bravery to do that. What unbelievable bravery. But this is what it is, exactly what you guys are saying. The fear is being lifted. This is a major sign of the consciousness shift of what we're looking for. Once humanity as a whole will lose its fear, particularly religions, governments, dictators, etc., can no longer have control over people. If you no longer fear dying, there's nothing anybody can do to you. Nothing.
It gave me goosebumps was in Egypt when the Christians actually stood guard while the Muslims did their prayers. I mean, it was like bringing everybody together. It was wonderful.
And it was wonderful. And then they reversed it. On the other hand, there was a Christian prayer day, and the Muslims formed a cordon, a ring around the Christians, and allowed them to pray. This is the point. This is what these Muslim Brotherhood said to me. This man said to me, I am Egyptian. I am Muslim first, but I am Egyptian. And I have Christians that are Egyptian. I have Jews that are Egyptian. I have non-believers that are Egyptian. They are all my brothers. So that's the point. That is the strongly identifying with being Egyptian.
This is very powerful. I mean, it really does. It does say that people really realize people are human in every in every way. Everyone is, and they're honoring people. This is where we need to go, and it looks like that's where we're going, you know?
It's beautiful. It is. It's all the things you've been talking about on your shows for years, all the things that we've all been doing. I mean, we've all, you know, Hakim used to call it the dawn was coming. So we'd always come to say, okay, Papa, when's it coming? And we'd say, you know the expression, it's always dark.
Stephen?
He cut out.
I know. Hi, Stephen.
Wait, hold on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, Taz and I saw the Dalai Lama.
Oh.
We were first row. I mean, it was a wonderful experience.
Oh.
But his whole theme that day was all religions should come together and honor each other.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's one man that's always been miles ahead of everybody else. I remember him. It's just totally in one short little sentence. I mean, people ask, what is the real meaning of life? What's the goal? He said, simply, be happy and serve others.
Yeah.
If we all live that way.
I think we can. I believe it. It's just not Pollyannish. It's just not being a super optimist. We once did live that way. Everything goes in cycles. That's the key to our teachings. It's coming around again. I believe we can live that way again, and I believe it again. People realizing we're more similar, putting on our similarities instead of differences.
You keep cutting out. I don't know if it's because when somebody's calling you.
Not me. No, I don't have call waiting. It's not on my end.
Oh. I don't know, you keep cutting out, we don't know why, but anyway.
Like Dalai Lama said, you know, everything is secular, just really, and he was speaking to all the young people at the college, I mean, Stanford, it was really, it was nice seeing their responses cameras, we were able to see, you know, a lot of people's response to him when he was talking was very interesting.
I know. I love him. He's one of my favorite people.
Yeah. Well, I think the young people in all nations are the ones who are going to make the change and the shift.
And it is our task. It is our job, those of us that are becoming the elders, to continue to pass our this wisdom, the knowledge they had, the fact that those of us that have experienced, let the young people know what we went through. And I mean, the old people in Egypt now are telling the young people what they had to go through. It is. I mean, Hakim said it. Every great teacher has always said it. It's always the youth. It's always got to be the young that are the answer to whether humanity is backwards. And for the youth thinking they're getting all into the glitz and the glamour and the material and the being famous for 15 minutes of Dancing with the Stars and American Idol, all of this. But I see the change is coming with the youth of the world. And I think a lot of, like, the Egyptian youth, Libyan youth, the youth that are doing these things are going to influence the American youth to stop being so late and get to be like we were in the 60s when we went to the streets. It will be the students along with the workers, the disenfranchised, the unemployed in America who have to start hitting the streets.
Well, you know, the younger people just are so much alert, much more alert than we were when we were younger. And,
yes,
you know, it's really refreshing to see this.
It is.
Well, they have the Facebook, they have the Twitter. I mean, they're so much more exposed than what we were.
And the amazing thing is you can be talking to people all around the world. It is amazing.
I know, and you can even have Google that translates for you when we talk to them in a different language. We can just translate it.
Totally basic. Totally.
I know. I asked my nephew who was communicating with our relatives in Portugal. I said, I didn't know you spoke Portuguese. He goes, oh, I just go to Google and translate it.
Amazing. That is amazing. I know we're doing it. And people were sending messages from Egypt in Arabic, getting translations. It's pretty amazing. So I would tell people right now who are interested that I think it's safe to go back to Egypt. There are a lot of people concerned about that. I know a lot, of course, of the February tours were canceled. March tours have been canceled. A lot of them have been rescheduled for April and May. But I do know in March, and I've been group in March. Security's back. The sites are open. It's pretty safe. There never was. There had been at one point. It's interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, during the demonstrations where there was beginning to be a lot of anti-American sentiment, where there was a desire for Obama to speak out more, to back the protesters, et cetera, et cetera. But it never really got. They really. They want democracy. They want all the things that Americans have. They want to be able to have free speech, free assembly, freedom of press. For the first time in Egypt for 30 years now, you have a free press and television. Now, they're reporting, and they want to investigate Mubarak. They want to investigate Zahi Hawass. They want to actually be reporters again. I mean, so that is, I mean, it is a great thing that's happening. It's going to be, we have to watch it because it's going to take a lot of hard work. But I'm telling people you can come back October 15th to 28th. Word, body, mind, spirit. W, of course, one word, body, mind, spirit, journeys.com. I will be leading the tour. I'm going to be doing a series of powerful initiations at all the sites with my teacher's daughter, Sherazad, who eldest daughter, she inherited the legacy and the lineage of the family. We're going to be doing powerful initiations to get 3 to 6 weeks. They said the site seemed to be even more active with what's going on in Egypt. It is the awakening. It is the time for people to travel to the sacred sites in the world to get ready for the great shift in consciousness. So I'm going back. I'd go back tomorrow. I'm not afraid. And I'm telling everybody who's considering that, that in March seems like it's opening up again. Tourists are coming back, especially Europeans, and it will be safe.
Well, I think it would be a marvelous time to go back to see the new Egypt.
I'm excited about it. I can't wait to get back there. I know, people have been telling me that, like Nikki Scott with myself first in 1992. She's been to Egypt since 1978. She see it. I mean, everybody there is so excited. The energy is so strong. They feel that people are very enthusiastic, very positive and optimistic about what they can create for their future. So it will be a great time to go to the sites in Egypt.
Do you think that more of the secrets will be exposed also, because the government actually had a thumb on the information that was being released to the tourists?
Yes. Well, that's part of what I would like to see. Now that Mubarak's regime has been removed, people know my opinion on this. I would like to see Zahi Waas removed too. He's been under a lot of pressure. He actually was promoted by the new cabinet post, the Ministry of Antiquities, so he made Zahi a minister. He's the dissemination of information, there needs to be a new regime totally. There need to be some new blood, younger blood, take over the antiquities and allow more alternative research. One of the things Hawass did was stifle alternative research and make it very difficult for someone like I to do research and to promote. We're hoping, and I have met a lot of the younger Egyptologists in Egypt, a lot of them are more. I would like to see Zahi Waas removed. That is my feeling.
What's the procedure here as far as re-election in that area? I mean, do you know?
You mean he being elected? He's not elected. He's appointed. So the election would be of a new government. Once you have a prime minister or a president, they then would be there. So somebody could reappoint Waas. Somebody could tell him to retire.
Well, that
they're
could
not
happen
elected.
Very naturally. That could happen very naturally then.
Yes, and again, here's another example, quickly. It's estimated that Egypt takes $5 and $7 billion a year in tourism. I think it's a low estimate. But that Egyptologists were unemployed. His bribery, et cetera. It just means you've gone to school for 4 years, you have a BA degree, you may have even gone on a couple extra years and got a doctorate in Egyptology. They get paid in Egyptian pounds a month. That's about $75.
Wow.
For professors. And Hawass takes home millions per year. That's the difference. What you have is a separation from the haves and the have-nots. Under Mubarak in the last 20 years, you've developed a very strong, wealthy class that have been bilking Egypt. There's goes out of the country. So the gap between those and those, most Egyptians only exist on a couple of dollars a day. And Mubarak is estimated to be worth $70 billion.
I know, he had homes all over, and it's unbelievable.
He had property on Park Avenue in New York. He had property in Piccadilly Circus in London, et cetera, besides Swiss bank accounts all over the world.
Well, Stephen, are you on a landline?
Yes, I am.
You are. That's interesting.
Yes.
Because we are getting tremendous amounts of space where we can't hear you.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm hearing you guys perfect. No, I'm on a
So you just now, you're cutting out right now.
Wow, I'm sorry. I don't hear it. I'm not hearing it myself. Any problem in the line?
Well, you want to give out your website one more time so people
yes.
can look at it? You cut out again.
BodyMindSpiritJourneys.com.
So I think this would be, if anyone ever wanted to go to Egypt, I think this would be the perfect time to see all the changes and to see all the energy there. It's just would be marvelous.
I agree.
Yeah, I saw Nikki on her Facebook. She put up, I think it was one of the television stations, Portland, actually interviewed her about Egypt.
Yes.
And,
Nikki, the Grateful Dead.
I know, I went with Nikki, and that was the most marvelous trip I've ever gone on. So, and you get the Egyptian people, you get to know them and how loving group of people they are. And they're
yes.
wonderful.
Yes, Nikki, like myself, has very, very deep connections with the Egyptian people, so she's a great person to go with.
And you as well, so.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh.
It would be
so
fun
for
you, too.
Go ahead. I was going to say, your website is BodyMindSpiritJourneys.com.
Good.
And is Journey spelled J-O-U-R-N-Y-S?
No.
You got to do it again.
Okay, Body Journeys, Journey spelled JOURNEYS.com.
Okay, NEYS. Okay, good. Thanks.
Right. It's a brand new website. Current tours.
I was going to say that in my memory bank, that sounded different than what you had before.
Well, it's a group I've worked with since 2000.
Now, do you ever go to the ruins in Mexico?
I haven't yet. That's one of the... I mean, being the fact that I'm a crystal skull researcher, I have not... that are on my list.
I just went to... I just came back from Chichen Itza, and it was wonderful.
I just did a conference, a crystal skull conference with Hunba, the Itza area, Yucatan.
Oh, in the Yucatan. So is there going to be another Crystal Skull Conference in the United States?
Yes, there's several. There are many that are being scheduled. The one I'm most going to be involved with will be 11-11-11, and it will be in Los Angeles. And that website is OracleStoneProductions.com.
Oh, that's really close. We can just fly right down there. That's
I'd
wonderful.
Love to see you guys there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
11-11-11.
November the 11th, 2011, huh?
Yep.
Okay.
And there will be awesome. Mayan elder skulls.
You
oh,
got to
wow.
say it again. What did he say?
There will be Mayan elders at the conference 11-11-11, and there will be many ancient crystal skulls.
Whew. My goodness. Where do you know where it's going to be held right now?
No, that is yet to be determined.
Okay.
And what which elders are going to be there, or do we know yet?
Well,
oops.
Joe, Hunba.
Can you try again, Stephen?
Okay.
Try again, would you?
I'm sorry.
Oops.
We can't hear Stephen.
Can't hear you.
There you go.
Am I gone? Okay.
Yeah, you're on.
Don
Ruiz, probably.
Don Ruiz. Hunbat Pedro.
Oh, my gosh.
The longer we go, the more you're cutting out. So I don't,
gee,
know.
I don't
yeah.
know what it is. Hmm.
I think what we need to do is maybe you can email us and we can put the information on our website, okay?
We'll do.
Okay.
We'll do that.
That would be really good. It's been such a wonderful journey with you today, really hearing what's going on throughout the world and just being in touch. It's like, you know, we're touching fingers and being able to really listen to what's going on.
I agree.
We've learned quite a bit.
We all feel that connection.
Well, we've learned, and I'm sure that our listeners our listeners have they've learned a lot today. So we appreciate you taking your time with us and educating us on what's going on more than what we hear on the news.
Well, thank you.
Well, he's cut out again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said I was sorry.
God bless you, Stephen, on your journey.
Thank you.
Our love is with you.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, Paula! You know,
we've let listeners know that we've been with Stephen Mehler, M E H L E R,
and you can head to our website TazandPaulaShow.com and be able to get the podcast up so you can listen to the program or make a connection with Stephen.
And we'll put information on our website so that you can connect with him. So thank you so much, Stephen, for being with us. We can't hear you, but...
Well, thank you both. Hear me.
You're welcome, Stephen.
Have a great day.
You too.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay.
Well, go hop on our Twitter, Taz and Paula, and make comments on today's show. Thanks. Bye-bye.